It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. For well over 150 years, debtors' prisons have been illegal in the United States. But that restriction only applies to private debts. In practice, public fines and court debts can be another story. In a study published last fall, between 25 and 2018, 8,000 residents of Wisconsin were jailed each year for failure to pay those kind of fines and debts. Our next guest will walk us through the causes and consequences of what some people are calling modern-day debt imprisonment in our justice system. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever spent time in jail for failing or being unable to pay a traffic fine or a court fee? Have you been threatened with jail time but found a way to pay? Do you have questions about this process? Do you think people should spend time behind bars for failure to pay these fees and fines? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. John, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Before we turn to these public debts and fines and fees, you read old-time stuff, people end up in debtors' prisons all the time way back in the day. Can you talk about the legal landscape now when it comes to private debt? In general, people don't end up in prison for that.
That's correct. We no longer rely on debtors' prisons. We have bankruptcy proceedings, the same is not always true in criminal courts. There's a lot of mandatory fees and fines that are imposed on people. People often have to pay costs associated with their own probationary sentence, their own monitoring. And if people don't pay some of those fees and fines, they can find themselves back in court and threatened with imprisonment.
Can you talk about the variety of either fines, I think include traffic tickets, and court fees that end up being part of this story?
Sure. There's a lot of different costs associated with even a minor trip through the criminal system, the criminal legal system. If you get a ticket, there are all sorts of fees and fines associated with it. Those fines and fees go to different government agencies. If you wind up being convicted of a crime, there are often mandatory court costs imposed. The state can actually charge you fees. If you had a lawyer appointed to your case, they can demand that you pay restitution. And so there's many, many different ways that people can find themselves with debt associated with everything from a relatively minor traffic ticket to a more serious charge that's adjudicated in a criminal court.
Talk us through then what leads to having those fines or court fees in place and then ending up in jail. As I mentioned, a report found 8,000 Wisconsinites per year, roughly over a long period, ending up in jail.
So the legislature has elected to impose mandatory fees when people are convicted of crimes, with the idea that it's both sort of a punishment, but also a way to help fund the criminal justice system that is adjudicating these cases. And so, and oftentimes those fees are not nominal, they're not minimal, they can be $400, $500, or $600. And most people in the country can't afford an emergency payment of more than $500. So people find themselves in debt to the court. Some courts, I think smartly, don't try to enforce that debt, but others do. And they do by issuing a warrant to have the person arrested for non-payment and brought back before a judge.
Are they then subject to more court fees since they're appearing in court again?
This can often lead to a cycle of debt. This is especially true of traffic offenses where, if you get a fine or a fee for speeding and you don't pay it, your license will then be suspended. And to get your license reinstated, you'll have to pay additional fees. And if you get another ticket, there's additional fees on that because now you have a suspended license and you're maybe still driving because you have to get to work or pick up your kids. And so people can really get caught in this spiral of debt related to just really minor infractions. Traffic tickets can lead to sizable debts for folks. And it winds up being a sort of hole that they can't dig themselves out of.
So if I, say, owe a court $500, just pick a number, and I can't pay it for whatever reason, so it goes through this process, I'm back in court, I'm sent to jail, what happens then? Is the fine waived? Is it per day you waive so much? What happens to my debt whilst I'm sitting in jail?
So I should say that before a judge can jail someone for non-payment of a fine, a fee, a court cost, or restitution, a judge first has to make a determination about whether or not the person actually can pay. Because we don't have debtors' prisons. And the problem arises when judges, frankly, don't do this. You can imprison someone who willfully fails to pay a debt owed to the court. It's a form of contempt of court. But if the person doesn't have the money, the Constitution and the Supreme Court has made it very clear, you can't put the person in jail. But oftentimes people don't know that. People don't have lawyers representing them because they're too poor to pay the fine. And judges don't always take the time to figure this out. And so people can indeed sit in jail when a judge has ordered that if the fine is paid, they'd be released. But there's no one to pay the fine.
Talking to John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project, talking about what some call, in effect, a modern-day system of debt imprisonment. But when it comes to debts for courts and fines, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions based on what you've heard so far or opinions? Maybe you've got an experience of your own to share. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, is there an official guideline or system for saying, okay, how do we assess whether this person is capable of paying these fines?
It's really incumbent upon a judge before resorting to incarcerating someone to question the person about their financial circumstances and to try to determine if they can pay something. Anything, or can they be put on a payment plan? Or in other instances, judges can sometimes simply substitute an alternative to payment of money, such as like community service, that they could resentence the person to do community service instead of having to pay a fine. And it's just a sort of common sense determination about whether or not somebody has the means to pay. And you know, inquiring about, are they employed? Do they have debts? Do they have dependents that they support? But without going through that, as I said, sometimes courts will just resort to imprisoning the person or issuing some type of a warrant for their arrest, which often leads to them being held in custody before they can see a judge who makes a determination that they can't pay this.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rembrandt is with us in Sun Prairie. Rembrandt, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Your guest mentioned that, okay, somebody can't pay, they get thrown in jail. How long do they stay there? Is it like 7 days and it's mandatory to let them go? Just curious.
Yeah, Rembrandt, I don't know if there's one specific answer to that, John. Does it vary? How long do people in jail in this situation end up staying in jail?
It really depends on the judge, because if a judge sentences someone, or it's not really a sentence, but if they commit someone to jail and say the person has this many days in jail or until the fine is paid, right? So a judge can say 3 days in jail, or if you pay the $500, you can get out. And that's typically the way a judge would structure it. Some jurisdictions will give you credit, a certain amount of money toward the debt you owe for every day that you spend in jail, which is, of course, sort of backwards because the local jail is actually paying to keep you in jail. So the attempt to recover money from the person actually leads to the county just spending more money in an effort to recover a debt that they're never going to be able to recover.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. My response to this is under the umbrella of personal responsibility. I think people who are guilty of nonviolent crimes know that they're breaking the law and they must pay the consequences. Therefore, I wish the state of Wisconsin would give an option to the offenders to work off their fine. For example, you go 80 and a 55 and you get a $172 fine. Maybe you could work 5 hours picking up garbage along the highway. Or something like that. I'd like to see something like that, because then we would have a responsibility toward our, you know, society.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. John, you mentioned that some judges might in fact assign a community service project like that as an alternative.
Yes, judges often do look for those alternatives and those options, community service being one of them when somebody can't afford to pay the fine and maybe they're not working. So a judge says, all right, well, then, you know, you have time to do community service. And that's the way they discharge their debt.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We're talking to John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project, talking with him about causes and consequences of people being jailed for nonpayment of public fines and court fees. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this yourself or has a family member? If you've worked as a lawyer, have you defended or prosecuted someone for the offense of failure to pay? Has a client of yours been in this situation? Join in with your thoughts, experiences, questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project, talking with him about challenges facing low-income people in the court system, including potentially jail time for failure to pay things like fines and court fees in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Michael is with us now in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for talking about this. I think this is something that doesn't frequently get, or a lot of people are unaware of. I just wanted to share, I haven't ended up being personally jailed for a debt owed, thankfully, though I know people who have. But I just wanted to echo the experience of it being so easy to end up trapped in this sort of cycle where maybe you have a small parking ticket that you can't afford. It's an extra expense you're already scraping by, and that turns into a slightly larger parking ticket, which then turns into your plates getting suspended, which then turns into, you know, you still have to pick your kid up from school, and you end up for a ticket for driving while suspended, and then you have to pay that on top of everything else, and it just very quickly becomes a situation that is even harder to get out of than the one you were in previously, where it was a, you know, $20 parking ticket that you couldn't pay.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. John, that refers back to something you mentioned about this cycle of public debt potentially increasing, snowballing. Is there a better way? Is there a solution to that happening where people are still held accountable, but don't end up with what could be seen as an excessive punishment for a traffic fee or a parking fee or what have you?
Well, I think one important aspect of this is that, you know, legislatures and courts should not expect courts to be self-funding, right? They shouldn't impose additional fees on people in addition to a fine that is supposedly, you know, deterring the conduct, but also imposing, you know, excessive surcharges and fees to basically help run the court at minimal expense. The other idea that people often bring up here is to have a sliding scale for fees. Obviously, if somebody is, two people are pulled over for speeding, one of them, as the caller just described, is just scraping by on minimum wage. The other one happens to be a doctor. Should they pay the same fine? Well, the fine won't deter the doctor from speeding down Main Street if he can pay it easily, but it might be too much for the other person to pay, and they might get trapped in debt. So, you know, calibrating the fine or the sanction to the person's actual means could be a good solution to this problem.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in La Crosse, I think, with thoughts along those lines. Mary, hi.
Hi. Yes, I was actually, that's exactly what I was calling about, was wondering how much thought had been put into something like paying according to your ability to repay.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Are there legal obstacles there? John, I could see if I'm the doctor in your scenario saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm not getting equal justice if I'm getting paid more than that other person who doesn't have to make as much money. This is unfair.
Well, I would look at it from sort of the opposite perspective, right? The idea of a fine is that it will deter people from engaging in the conduct. And I think that's, we don't treat criminal offenses like, you know, speeding or going through a red light as criminal, but we want to discourage them. So the fine or the sanction really needs to be tailored to what would deter the conduct. And for someone who's making minimum wage, maybe a $50 fine is enough of a deterrent, but somebody making $150,000 a year, not so much. So the idea would, again, be to really tailor the sanction to something that would be meaningful for that person. And I think that really, for most people, I think that would be equal justice.
Thanks again for that call, Mary. John Gross is with us from the UW Law School and the Public Defender Project, looking at people being jailed in some cases, about 8,000 people a year in Wisconsin, for non-payment, sometimes inability to pay court fees and public fines. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. John, I want to dig into a related issue that you've mentioned a couple times, public defenders. I think there's an assumption like, okay, you're in court, you're a defendant, you can't afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you, but will it? How does the court system determine, okay, you can't afford a lawyer of your own, so here you go, public defender?
So most states have indigency guidelines, which is basically a formula or a number that says if you make more than this, you presumably don't qualify for a public defender. If you make less, you do. And not all states have those numbers calibrated very well. I can tell you that in Wisconsin, the threshold for eligibility is set right around the federal poverty guidelines, and that is very low. So basically, there's a lot of people in Wisconsin, for example, who would be eligible for home heating assistance under federal programs, but Wisconsin would tell them that they're not eligible for a public defender. And the other problem with this, where we see really these issues, this snowballing effect come, is that, you know, for many minor offenses like traffic, people aren't in danger of going to jail, so they don't get appointed a public defender, even if they're too poor to hire a lawyer. And so it isn't until much later, when they owe large amounts of debt and a judge is threatening them with putting them in jail, that a lawyer becomes involved and should be appointed to the case. But by then, they've already accrued the debt, and it's kind of too late to unring the bell.
Do you have thoughts on how Wisconsin could revise that system? Is there another state that you would point to and say, yeah, we should do it that way?
Well, I think the best thing for the Wisconsin legislature would be to not really dictate this on a statewide basis, because your ability to hire a lawyer depends not just on your own financial means, but it also depends on the seriousness of the charge and whether or not there are lawyers in that area who can represent you and are willing to represent you that you can hire. So it's a difficult determination to make about who should be getting appointed lawyers and who shouldn't be. And so it's really something that doesn't do well with a cookie cutter one size fits all approach. I think Wisconsin would be better served by giving judges and the public defender's office more flexibility in making these determinations and allowing them to consider the sort of economic realities of the place where the person is being prosecuted.
That sounds like it leaves a lot at the discretion of a local judge then, and Judge A might have a very different standard than Judge B in the same court or in different parts of the state.
That is true, and that is certainly a concern. But I think people should be aware that the vast majority of people in our criminal courts are actually too poor to hire a lawyer. The numbers suggest at least 80%, maybe even 90% of people who are arrested just simply can't afford a lawyer. And frankly, one of the best ways for judges to figure this out is if the person keeps coming back to court and tells the judge, I can't find a lawyer to represent me. Well, it seems like they're too poor to hire a lawyer, and the judge should consider appointing counsel to represent them in the criminal case.
Time for one more caller. Kylie is with us in Sparta. Kylie, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
Okay, so I'm probably not going to be popular with this, but I actually think there's two parts to this. First of all, I think that the fines right off the bat should be more expensive. So for instance, instead of a speeding ticket, you know, $170-some, whatever, started out at $1,000 minimum, okay? That's going to deter quite a few people from the behavior, okay? Then when you have that price, then you can then look at what you're talking about today. And done doing like community service, you know, have to fine or whatever.
Kylie, thanks for the call. John Heyer finds for better deterrence, Kylie says.
Well, we've been trying this for a long time in the United States. We've been trying to be tougher on crime. We increase fines, we increase fees, we increase the amount of time people spend in jail. But honestly, all of the research in this area shows that at a certain point, it's not a good deterrent. And so I don't think you can find your way out of the typical traffic infraction.
Kylie, thanks for the call. In our last minute, John, you've been working on these issues of the impact of the legal system on low income defendants and people who get fines and fees. Do you get a sense that people in the court community and the legislature are thinking about these things too?
Well, I think we've sort of settled into this sort of pattern where courts are used to assessing all sorts of fees and fines. And every year the legislature seems to come up with a new additional fine or fee that they can inflict on somebody who's convicted of a crime. And of course, people who are convicted of crimes, they're not popular. And so this is sort of a way of a legislature continually imposing a tax on poor people who don't really have a voice to push back against this. And so I think we really need to have a change in thought about this, because all the research, and as this report shows, much of this debt never goes collected. And in fact, the state spends even more money trying to collect it. So just from an economic perspective, it's not a winner. It's not doing the thing it's supposed to do, which is helping offset the cost of prosecution for these offenses.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project. We talked to him about the risk of jail time for low-income Wisconsinites who are unable to pay public fines or court fees. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Representatives from South Africa were in The Hague in Netherlands last week, making opening arguments before the United Nations International Court of Justice, arguing that Israel has committed, quote, genocidal conduct, end quote, against Palestinians in Gaza, and that the latest war follows what South Africa alleges is a pattern of violence going back to 1967. Here's Adila Hassim, a lawyer for South Africa, speaking last week.
For the past 96 days, Israel has subjected Gaza to what has been described as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare. Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry and bombs from air, land, and sea. They are also at immediate risk of death by starvation, dehydration, and disease as a result of the ongoing siege by Israel, the destruction of Palestinian towns, the insufficient aid being allowed through to the Palestinian population, and the impossibility of distributing this limited aid while bombs fall. This conduct renders essentials to life unobtainable.
Israel's government has denied the claim of genocide, arguing that they're in the midst of a military response to the Hamas attacks in Israel in October. We're going to talk about what genocide means, both in a legal sense and in the public understanding of the concept, and how the international legal system functions in claims of genocide. We'll also take a look at South Africa's arguments, Israel's response, and what happens next in that case. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about genocide, how it fits into international law, whether that law is enforced? What do you want to know about how the International Court of Justice and how it operates, what jurisdiction or enforcement power it has? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Damir Kovacevic is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, where he teaches on topics including international conflict and political violence, and his research interests include genocide studies. Damir, thanks a lot for joining us today.
my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
How is genocide defined under international law?
So genocide under international law is, it's a very specific, precise legal definition. And the definition that the ICJ is using in this case that you just mentioned, and the one that the United Nations would be looking at and other international courts, is the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. And there's, I think, three elements that are worth pointing out when kind of distinguishing genocide from other forms of political violence and other international crimes. That first one is probably the most important. That's the intent, which is different from motivations or merely actions, right? Proving that the perpetrator actually had the intent to destroy this specific group. The other two would be group selectivity, which we just mentioned related to those four groups, and then group destructiveness, which it doesn't have to include the whole group, but a substantial portion of that group.
What do you think people misunderstand or get wrong about genocide when we talk about it kind of in the popular press?
Yeah, it's a question that, you know, I get a lot, and it's a question that, you know, in my own classes, we have to kind of grapple with, and we debate, and even in the social science literature, the definition that the courts have established is narrow, I think, and that's precisely what they wanted, because they're looking into this from a legal standpoint, and it's a very serious allegation, right? So it's a serious crime. So proving intent can be very difficult, and that was the point. When we look at it from kind of a popular standpoint, or we just kind of the eye test itself, what we're looking at and what we're saying is, well, we're seeing mass killing. And mass killing, of course, is also a very serious, grave concern, as are things like war crimes and crimes against humanity and, of course, ethnic cleansing. But they don't necessarily carry that intent to destroy. And I think that's where we sort of distinguish genocide, at least from a legal standpoint. Now, in the social science literature and in my own literature, sometimes we might use various other definitions that still allude to genocide, but aren't kind of restricted by that intent in that legal sense.
And we didn't hear the whole case made by South Africa. The portion we heard, there are portions that address that intent. The portion we heard, somebody might hear that and say those might be war crimes against civilians that might not rise to the level of something we would call genocide. Is that a possible argument to make?
That's a possible argument. And if, for instance, the court does, you know, rule on that and says, okay, it might not be genocide, but we may determine that war crimes have been committed. Well, if they're making that claim, what they're looking at is then essentially three factors. They're looking at, does Israel have the military necessity, does Israel have the military necessity to respond? Is it responding in a proportional manner? And are they distinguishing between civilians and combatants? Many will claim that, of course, there is a military necessity because this is a right to self-defense going back to the October 7th attack. But I think where people are having issues with that is the proportional response, which many have said has been disproportionate. And of course, being able to distinguish between civilians and combatants, as we've seen the civilian death toll rise to about 24,000 with the most recent projections.
I want to talk about the concept of proportional response. As I understand it, and I may be completely wrong, Damir, that doesn't mean you look at the number of people killed on each side or the proportion of population on each side, but is the military effort by Israel targeting Hamas's military capacity proportionate with the damage it's doing to the need to do it, that military necessity you mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. So it you know, the right to self-defense is also, you know, rooted in international law, protected in international law, that doesn't give an actor, in this case Israel, the right to sort of say, okay, well, because we were attacked first, we have the right now to respond in any way that we want. That response must be proportional with, and again, that there isn't a specific threshold there, but, you know, proportional in terms of what happened on October 7th, what is a proportional response to that? And then, of course, attached to that, as I just mentioned earlier, is that distinction. In matters of war, you're never going to be able to completely eliminate civilian lives. And I think that international law covers that as well. But are you making a deliberate effort to distinguish between, a military target, which is, you know, covered under international law, which was considered a necessity, which we consider proportional, and then, of course, civilian combatants, which we consider out of bounds, sort of not covered by international humanitarian laws or the laws of armed conflict.
Demir Kovacevic is with us, political scientist at UW-Eau Claire, looking at genocide as it is reflected in international law, the nation of South Africa challenging Israel in a court, the International Court of Justice. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Demir, looking at the court now, we've got this International Court of Justice. What is it? What is its role?
So the International Court of Justice is one of the main bodies of the United Nations. So if anyone's familiar with the United Nations, they have probably heard of things like the General Assembly, right? The Parliament of Nations. They've heard of the Security Council, the P5, which the United States and Russia and China have a seat on, and France and the United Kingdom. The International Court of Justice hears disputes between states specifically, right? And that's what they're doing in this case. And in a previous case back in 2019, they did rule that an outside party, in this case South Africa, can bring these kinds of charges before the court, because if both parties are signatories of the Genocide Convention, in which case Israel and South Africa both are, it has the right to do that. And so it hears these disputes between states. And I say that to distinguish it from another court, which has a similar name, but has a different kind of role, and that's the International Criminal Court, the ICC, which also operates in The Hague, which, you know, in the Netherlands. That court specifically deals with individuals related to war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. So the ICJ, in this case, is hearing this specifically as state disputes. It doesn't normally hear these kinds of cases. It usually deals with cases of, like, border disputes or resources. But it is a court that, for instance, this kind of topic can be brought to it.
Suppose the court rules that in one state, South Africa in this case, brings this charge against another, Israel. Suppose this court did end up ruling hypothetically that, yes, this is genocide. What then? Do they have any kind of enforcement powers?
Well, the decision is legally binding. I mean, if for those of us that study international politics, I mean, international law is a thing. But what I remind people is international law is very different from domestic law because of this question of enforceability and accountability, right? Ultimately, the question is, well, could Israel ignore this ruling? Absolutely. Have we seen this in the past? Yes, we have. Usually from powerful states who may not necessarily agree with the decision. In this case, Israel has called it meritless. We've heard the United States referred to it as that. So they could simply just say, you know, we don't agree with it and we're going to continue on. Now, from a legal standpoint, you could say, okay, it doesn't have much effect that in that sense. But from the sort of public court of public opinion and sort of the diplomatic pressure, it could send a very symbolic message. And it could, of course, affect how others view Israel. It could affect, its role continuing on. But another thing that I would point out is that any kind of decision here will probably take months, if not likely years. So we're not going to probably hear anything anytime soon.
We're talking about the legal meaning of genocide, and at the case South Africa brought to the United Nations International Court of Justice last week, alleging that Israel has been committing genocidal conduct in Gaza during their military response to the Hamas attacks in October in Israel. Demir Kovacevic stays with us, assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? How do you think the international community should handle claims, accusations of genocide? Do you have thoughts on what you want to see, if anything, come out of this court on these charges filed against Israel? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Demir Kovacevic, assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, talking about what constitutes genocide in the legal sense, and the case that South Africa has brought before the UN's International Court of Justice, alleging that Israel has been committing genocidal conduct in Gaza. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Milwaukee. Jack, hi.
Hello. Yeah, the question I got is sort of a historical one here, because I think there's maybe a wider problem. South Africa brought this case, but if you go all the way back to World War II, as I understand it, when the Russians and the Germans essentially eliminated Poland as an existing state. I believe the Nazis took the position they could do anything they wanted on that land because it didn't exist as a nation state. And that probably affects an awful lot of other conflicts in the world where you don't have some third-party signatory to a genocide treaty just sitting on their hands and doing nothing.
Jack, thanks for the call. Damir, the idea that, okay, if someone is not a state, doesn't have a functioning government that they can point to, does that make it difficult for them to have standing in the international legal system?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that courts have ruled on in the past in relation to genocide is that even in cases where you might not be a signatory, let's say, to the Genocide Convention, with many states are, generally customary international law still prohibits, you know, incitement of genocide or committing acts of genocide. And of course, the Palestinian people, although they are not viewed as a state by, you know, the entire international community, right? There's debate over what countries which countries acknowledge Palestinian status, which don't. The Palestinian people, of course, are recognized as a group and protected under that definition. Now, of course, that definition has issues. There are some that say the definition is kind of narrow because it only protects those four specific groups. But in this case, what we're referring to would, of course, capture, you know, the civilians living in Gaza.
Thanks for the call, Jack. And bringing up World War II, Damir, how much of our current system of international law, especially when it comes to genocide, has its origins in World War II and the what I think everyone agrees on is the attempted genocide of Jewish people in Europe?
Yeah, so the term does originate, you know, the term genocide, right, as coined by a Polish lawyer, Raphael Lemkin, in 1944. Largely in response to what was happening during the Holocaust, but also, you know, in response to, let's say, the Armenian genocide or genocides that preceded that as well. The concept itself didn't have, let's say, legal standing, for instance, at the Nuremberg trials when they were overseeing and sort of when they convicted German perpetrators at that time of crimes against humanity and war crimes. In that time, genocide itself was a descriptive term. Now, post-1948, with the Genocide Convention and sort of the emergence of the United Nations, it not only now carries a kind of a descriptive term, a kind of a definition that we all understand it, and now has kind of legal standing. And from then on, it has been kind of adopted by other statutes. So if you think of the 1998 Rome Statute, which essentially establishes the International Criminal Court, genocides also covered in that respect. And so that court can hear cases brought before it, and it has since 2002.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Ben is with us now in Watertown. Ben, hi, what did you want to bring up?
Hi, well, I was just wondering, you know, we're talking genocide, and, well, first of all, it seems like the amount of women and children that they're reporting killed is a little bit off. You know, those are numbers given by Hamas, so I'm actually wondering how accurate that is. And because the Gaza population has been so supportive of Hamas and their actions, is there like a little, I don't know, more acceptable, I guess, civilian casualty rate than there would be normally? Because these people are, I don't want to say getting what they asked for or anything. I know they're living under an oppressive regime, but they're allowing, you know, 30,000 Hamas rebels to, you know, dictate what, you know, the Gaza Strip, which has what, a population of how many million, you know, they haven't, you know, kicked them out and they're the leading party. I was just wondering, you know, I guess how that relates in order to genocide, because
Ben, I think I take your point. This concept of, okay, can civilians in a society be held accountable for the actions of their leaders? I've seen the argument go the other way from Palestinian terrorist groups over the years, saying that all Israeli citizens are accountable for the and therefore viable targets because of the actions of their government. How does that hold up in international law, Damir?
Well, again, a good question. And, you know, and you know, we see, you know, regardless of, let's say, the political support that civilians may have for a certain regime or for a certain group, I think, again, it comes back to that element of, you know, international humanitarian law, which is civilians are not legitimate targets when it comes to military operations, even legitimate military operations. Of course, nobody is a legitimate target when it comes to genocide. So again, we go back to the question of necessity, proportionality, and distinction, regardless of what people's sort of political opinions may be or support or lack thereof for Hamas.
Thanks for the call, Ben. Damir, getting back to the idea of intent now when it comes to this South African case against Israel, there have been some people in the Israeli government using phrases like, you know, we should drop an atomic bomb or a second basically catastrophe for the Palestinian people. And then the war cabinet saying you're out of the war cabinet. They're not speaking for us. This is an operation targeting Hamas. Is that an important distinction as we're talking about genocide? If the war cabinet in Israel is saying this is a Hamas-targeted operation not intended for genocidal means?
It is important, and that's, I think, the case that Israel made before the court. And, of course, those comments that we've heard, and we've heard other comments, from Netanyahu that people said, are those comments sort of getting close to the sort of the borderline of genocidal intent or genocidal acts? Of course, they're comments that we don't want to hear, that we don't want to see. And so making that distinction, making that separation is, of course, important, because response to what happened October 7th against Hamas is legitimate and something that I think everyone can kind of support. Making that distinction that this is a war against Hamas and not a war against the Palestinian people is something that Israel has to do and has to do clearly.
I've seen the argument out there, Damir, that Hamas at various stages in its existence has had genocidal aims targeting the people of Israel, basically in its constitution. Could a non-state actor, a political party controlling a state in this case, be charged with genocide itself?
They could. Again, what that would mean is very difficult to predict. I mean, the ICJ... last year or the year before that also ruled and said that Russia must cease its military operations in Ukraine. And we're at year three now with that war. So those things can be heard. Those things can be brought up. It's a little bit more difficult. But again, it goes back to this idea of legal enforcement, which is always the case and always an issue with when it comes to international law.
What are you watching for in a case like this before the International Court of Justice? What are you watching for in the, you said it wasn't a fast process, the days and months to come?
I guess what I'm looking to see is what this preliminary order might be. They may rule on this kind of preliminary order and say Israel must stop or limit its onslaught. And we've already kind of seen rhetoric coming out of Israel saying that they're kind of phasing out some of those operations. And I think some of that pressure has come from the United States. But hearing the court say that might be a first step, because I don't anticipate any kind of ruling for years to come. But they might have kind of a preliminary order, which could, of course, have diplomatic repercussions for Israel.
And if there's a finding against Israel or any other country, for that matter, is the country as a whole then responsible, or are leaders in some way held individually responsible in the International Court of Justice?
That's something that they're going to have to figure out. That's a very complicated task. If this was brought before the ICC, they'd be bringing in specific individuals, right, and citing those specific individuals that they want prosecuted. In this case, it's a state against a state. And so if this ruling does come in favor of South Africa, then the decision will have to be made. Well, who in that state is actually responsible for that? And we've never seen such a decision before. So that will be interesting to see.
Damir, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Damir Kovacevic is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. He studies, among other things, international conflict and genocide. We talked to him about the international community's approach to charges of genocide after South Africa accused Israel of committing genocidal acts in Gaza. They took that case to the International Court of Justice. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Wisconsin's lakes had a slow start when it came to ice this season. Is this week's big freeze helping them catch up? Check out the lake ice levels around the state, and you could share reports from your local waterways. You can start the conversation right now with an email to ideas@wpr.org. Is your local lake or pond or river freezing over? Did it come later than usual? And is this something you've been watching eagerly if you, say, are into ice fishing or skating or pond hockey, or the list goes on and on? Share your observations and what it means to you. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. then join the conversation with Kate and her guest. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Hey, I missed this yesterday. It was the 50th anniversary of a big piece of Wisconsin and Milwaukee pop culture history. Here's a hint. Hey. Yes, that was my Fonzie impersonation on January 15th, 1974. Happy Days made its debut on TV. The show was set in Milwaukee in a nostalgic look back at the 1950s. Now, it was set in Milwaukee, but mostly filmed on a soundstage in Los Angeles. And the main house where the Cunningham family lived? Yeah, that was in Los Angeles. Some of the exterior shots in Milwaukee were actually from Indiana. But still, it was Milwaukee enough that there is a bronze statue of the Fonz himself in Milwaukee. So it's an anniversary worth celebrating here in Wisconsin. Jumping the shark all day, every day, this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. People have probably been giving advice, solicited and unsolicited, for as long as there have been people. But as far as we know, the first official advice giving happened over 300 years ago in a British magazine called the Athenian Mercury. In the hundreds of years since, advice columns have thrived, as they likely will for as long as humans have advice to give and a place to publish that advice. Our next guest is a big name in the advice column world and joins us for behind-the-scenes look, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you read advice columns or listen to advice podcasts? What do you get from them? What's your favorite advice column? Is it the one written by Carolyn Hacks? Have you ever submitted a question to one of them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Carolyn Hacks has been writing an advice column for the Washington Post for just about three decades now. Carolyn, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I want to get your origin story, Carolyn. How did you become an advice columnist?
By insulting advice columns. I was working for an editor. I was already at the Washington Post as a news editor, and I was working with another editor who was thinking about taking on a new advice column for younger readers under some pressure from her bosses. And so I heard the names that she was considering and I gave my reviews. And I said, what you really need is a snotty 30-year-old writing one of these things. And lo and behold, I was 30 and had some snark problems. And I had a column probably within 3 to 5 weeks. I can't remember exactly the turnaround time, but it was pretty quick.
Now, you've evolved the column. It's now not just for younger readers and advice seekers, but were there unique things for, say, I guess it'd be Gen X readers at the time that you thought you could meet the needs of that they weren't getting from some of the longer running advice columns?
I thought so. Now with a little bit of hindsight, I just think what I had was an attitude. And but at the same time, I think just reading things that weren't to me to my ear weren't in our language was a problem. And I thought that the message wouldn't necessarily get across if it was just a bad fit. And a funny thing is, even with all of the opinionated approaches that I took to what I was doing, I've always believed all along that people are just people. And so I think it was more a matter of what is going to deliver a fairly universal message, but in a targeted or tailored or entertaining way.
Now, people ask you very personal and weighty questions, you know, whether to stay in a marriage, whether to have more kids, how to deal with dysfunctional family dynamics. The list goes on and on. Once you've gotten a question, you've decided this is what you're going to tackle. What's your method? How do you approach it?
Well, I'm just going to stop you for a second. When you list it that way, it sounds impossible. Like, what am I doing? somebody asking me if they should stay in their marriage. Pass. I don't know. but But it's funny, once you get into the mode, once you get into the answering mode, you just sort of you're immersed in it and you believe in it. And I think my method is to approach each question with suggestions for how to think, because I don't think it's necessarily appropriate. I mean, I was just joking about it, but I really don't think it's appropriate for me to say, wow, you got to get out of there, right. Except in very extreme circumstances, which I do sometimes. But most of the time it's, okay, here's the situation you described to me. Here are the five things I would think about. Or here's where I would start this process. Or here are the small things that you can do to help you see if you can feel better that way, with a very limited reach into your list of changes, and see if that helps. You know, so it's very measured, actually. I try to keep the writing I try to keep the writing loose, but the advice is very conservative, actually.
Carolyn Hacks is with us. Carolyn's been writing an advice column at the Washington Post for about 30 years, just about. You could join in with your questions about what it's like to be an advice columnist. If you read advice columns, Carolyn's or others, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Stephanie is with us in Madison. Stephanie, hi.
Hi there, Rob, and hi, Carolyn Hacks. You are one of my favorite columnists. I just called to basically tell you that when I heard that there was going to be an advice columnist on this show, I called to find out, and I'm like, oh, yay! I really like the way you approach problems, because, you know, you don't preach to people. You don't put yourself above people. Your advice is very intelligent, you know. You look at things that are, here's the situation. These are things you realistically can control or not control. But you're very thoughtful. And you've described keeping your advice conservative, except in like extreme situations, and being, you know, looking at ways of thinking about the problem. And I really appreciate that a lot. I mean, I'm dealing with my own stuff right now, but we always are, you know, no matter what. I'm going to turn 74 at the end of this month, and I've been losing my vision and other things. But, you know, I mean, I personally really look, I find the advice columns, yours, Ask Amy, the Miss Manners, I find them very helpful.
Stephanie, thank you so much. Carolyn, Stephanie, clearly, I imagine a lot of people like this find reading your advice columns, maybe others, helpful, even if it isn't their particular question that day.
I hope so. I mean, first of all, I want to say thank you. That was a lovely comment. I can't ask for a better reader. I really appreciate that. And I also, aside from the kind words, I feel really seen on sort of what I'm trying to get across. And so, and of course, you never know. I'm having a really one-sided conversation here. I'm just sort of banging away at my laptop, and I can't always know that what I intend is going to be received that way. And so to have somebody recognize that I'm not trying to make pronouncements from on high is really lovely to hear. But now it's... I forgot the question you asked me.
you answered it. I think that people are getting something out of your column, even if it's, you know, even if Stephanie didn't write the question you answered that day. Yeah.
Right. Well, and of course, yes. And I did have an answer in mind for that. So that's why I wanted to circle back to it. but I think that when you were asking me earlier about my approach, and one of the things that I try to keep in mind is that there's always a second answer. So there's the primary answer that addresses the narrow topic that somebody has brought up. But to me, there's always a second answer, which associates that narrow issue with its context. And I think when you start bringing things into context and connecting it to other things, that's when you really start to address other people as well. And also, I think you get it more of the issue if you treat it in context instead of in isolation.
Thanks a lot for the call, Stephanie. We'll go to Fawn now in Madison. Fawn, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to. I'm kind of like the last column. I call it. Sorry. I just wanted to say. Sorry about that. I just wanted to say. Oh no! Why just when I get on the line, I start to sneeze.
That's the fear of live radio. That coughing fit, Fawn. But it's okay.
Okay. No, I really appreciate
your
column.
I have this effect on
people. Oh, dear. No, I really appreciate your column. I like your approach and your fresh tone, your fresh voice, basically. Sounds. I guess that's what you were aiming for from the beginning. And that exactly, you do give advice that is really measured, and it seems to me sensible and sensitive at the same time. And you, with a well-rounded, you know, perspective. Rare have been the occasions I've disagreed with you, or occasionally I've wanted to chime in and say, and this, or have you considered this? And I also like that you seem to crowdsource some of your, or you allow readers to chime in online, I suppose, and then, you know, put their two cents in, some of which you excerpt and publish also.
Fawn, thanks a lot for the call. I wanted to bring that up, Carolyn. There's some call and response there. You give your take, and often you'll share other readers' thoughts for the initial question asker.
Yeah, so that comes from a live online chat that I do, and I don't have anybody reading my answers before I post them. So this is truly live, even though I'm slow. I mean, it's sort of live in a tortoise-like kind of way. But there's no net, there's no you know, delay button to make sure I don't say something horrible. So one of the things that's so, I think, different about this chat is I get to have crowdsource corrections as I go, or my incomplete answer that I throw out there in 2 minutes gets completed by reader feedback. And so when we decided to, the decision to include the adapted columns from these transcripts was part of a decision to go daily. And I said I didn't want to go daily with all new material plus the chats, because I said then I would be rushing. I want to be able to take my time. And so we did this combination of the three columns that original each week that I take my time with, and then we adapt the transcripts of the chats. And so I decided to preserve the format of my throwing out a possibly complete but more likely incomplete answer that gets completed by other observations. And I don't know, I enjoy it. I don't know if readers appreciate it. Sometimes I get people saying, like, I'm not reading your column to see what other people have to say. But then I also get criticism sometimes that, oh, you know, you never admit you're wrong. I'm like, I bring in other voices almost every column saying, well, I think that, you know, I think there's this perspective also. So I don't know. I think it rounds out what I'm trying to do. And again, which includes acknowledging that how I look at something is not the be all and end all. We're all different. We all come at the same problem in very different ways. And so having somebody else look at it, I think adds something.
Fawn, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about advice columns. Our guest is Carolyn Hacks, who's been writing an advice column at the Washington Post for pretty near three decades now. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to advice podcasts or read advice columns? Do you ever apply what you hear there to your own life? Have you ever written in a question to Carolyn or other advice columnists? Did you get good advice? Do you go way back with advice columns to where you know, would read them in a newspaper? And maybe write back with your own take on it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about advice columns, their popularity, what we can learn from them with person who writes one. Carolyn Hacks is with us. She writes an advice column at the Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for Carolyn about what it's like to write an advice column. If you are a fan of hers or other advice columns, or nowadays podcasts or chats or you name it, love to hear your experience, what you like about it. 800-642-1234. Or if you have an old school favorite, the Dear Abbeys or Ann Landers's, join it at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Nick is with us in Beloit. Nick, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I had a weird question about writing for an advice column, which was, do you ever get someone writing in asking you something where you just wonder, why are they asking me this? Who am I to answer this question? And also, I was curious, like, when you have something like that, like, I mean, I know you said that you wrote them more or less live, but is there a certain amount of fear that goes into giving the wrong advice?
Interesting, Nick. Carolyn?
Well, okay, so I'll answer the second one first. I spent a lot of time lying awake at night, especially when I first started doing this, because it is really presumptuous to just take a question that's maybe four paragraphs and say, okay, go do this with your life. I take that very seriously. And I think it's one of the reasons I developed the approach that I have now of just suggesting things for people to think about, because that takes my fingerprints off some things. It gets me out of people's business where I really don't belong. But I think the first part is, it reminds me a little bit of comedy where they say that the way to be funny is to just buy into the bit, just go all in. And I think the advice column is such a bizarre institution. I mean, it is a deeply bizarre institution when you think about it. And if I, you know, for example, I will get people following up with their questions, wondering why I haven't answered it yet. And I'm like, well, you haven't bought into the whole bit. I mean, this is a bunch of people, right? Basically, I think people are writing into the void. I don't think they realistically expect an answer, most of them. And I think it's just a way of just, it's like throwing coins in a fountain. And so what we're doing is more of a, instead of my speaking to somebody asking me a question, I think it's more of a collective experience of we're gonna throw out these things that I think everybody thinks about a little bit, or that I'm really struggling with. And I think I don't necessarily want to talk about with my friends. And so I'm going to throw it out there and see if we can air this public analysis of this issue. And I think that's been borne out in my experience, because sometimes when I answer people, they write back and say, oh my gosh, I never expected that this would get answered. And I think that's actually a very normal way of approaching this.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Marcus joins us next in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, Rob. So my great uncle Don used to tell me, when it comes to advice, that I should keep a rake and a broom. And I said, are we doing yard work? He said, no. He said, keep a mental rake and a mental broom. Rake in that which is useful to you and broom the rest. Because it's our own personal responsibility to determine what's right for us. So I think that by providing the advice, people are asking for it, and some might be writing into the void, as you say, but other people might actually, you know, they're actually asking the question. And so, you know, it just provides food for thought, and it's not your responsibility what they, you know, it's their decision that they ultimately make to take the advice or not.
Marcus, thanks
I'm
a lot.
Take
oh, good,
Carolyn.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really useful. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to put it above my desk.
Thanks a lot.
I answered you. Now it's not my problem.
Thanks a lot, Marcus. And that makes me wonder, Carolyn, do you have advice for advice column readers about what to do with your advice or others, how to engage with it in a way that says, okay, yes, I like this. I'm going to question that. I'm going to discard that.
I think you just said it. I think anything we read, though, and I don't think it applies just to advice or my advice or columns or podcasts. I think everything we come across presents us with a filtering challenge. And I think it's a healthy way to approach things, where you take what serves you or what is true. Since we want to talk about the broader context, you don't just take the information that serves you best and throw away the rest. I think you look at the big picture for what is correct and what is fair and what is useful, and use those pieces. And I think the more that we can gather, the more effectively we can screen and gather the information coming at us, I think the more successful we can be just as people.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Carolyn Hax is with us. She writes an advice column at the Washington Post, talking about advice columns. Carolyn, some things in the old media, whatever you call them, haven't translated well to the internet or have been replaced by a lot of other things. Advice columns. Now, people do go on Reddit and try to crowdsource advice, or Quora or whatever. There's a long, long list. But there's clearly still a demand for you and other particular personalities to keep doing this advice column. Why? Why did that that element of our older media stick around and find such appeal online?
I can't say that I know. thank goodness it did. But I think the things that the itches that an advice column satisfies are still there. And I think first of all, I think the advice columns have always been successful based on the voice behind them. And so that's something that that's something you get with a column, but you don't get with crowdsourcing. Although, again, we go back to the fact that I'm using other people, I'm picking up reader comments. I think actually there are some amazing thinkers and writers out there in my audience, and I love amplifying their voices. So, but I think that adds to what I'm doing, and it doesn't necessarily say, okay, crowdsourcing is a great alternative to a single voice column, because there's a familiar voice, and if you like the way somebody writes, or if you like the way somebody thinks, it's a familiar and welcoming place. And then the topic is so universal. I guess I'm talking about just being human. It's not, I'm talking about climate or politics or decorating. I mean, this is how we live. This is how we interact with people, and it's endless. The amount of connections we can make to our own lives in one column that might have nothing to do with our lives in particular.
Well, speaking of your voice, we heard from Rit in Madison who couldn't stay on the line. Rit says he's loved your columns for a long time, and his kids, Carolyn, coined the phrase, quote, bringing down the hacks. And that refers to saying things with lots of sass. You're a legend now. You are in a phrase in Rit's family. How do you feel about that?
I wish you'd been able to stay on, because I want to ask him, like, do they hate me?
I get the sense it's very positive. Yeah, I don't know. No, Rit's a fan, it sounds like. Carolyn, can you leave us in just our last, a little less than a minute now, with a bit of advice when we have that, interpersonal friction in our lives, a starting point to step back and think things through, whether or not we write to an advice column?
Yes. Oh, my God. I think that the happiness is inversely proportional to the number of things you take personally. So if somebody does something awful, if you choose to recognize it as something as their thing and not speaking directly to you, it's very calming. It's just it's a wonderful release. Fewer arguments.
It's a great place to leave it. Carolyn, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you again for having me.
That's Carolyn Hacks. Carolyn's been writing an advice column at the Washington Post for a good long time now. She talked with us about how she approaches her work and what we can learn from advice columns. Still time for you to share your favorite advice columns, past or present. Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, this week's Iowa caucus opened the real presidential nomination campaign for Republicans anyway. We'll dig into the results and the road ahead and what is at stake for the country. And hearing loss can create a lot of difficulties in daily life. It can also have links to the risk of dementia. Find out why that is and what kind of treatments and tools could help with the problem. And as always, you can join in with your questions, maybe your family experiences, that and more. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.